Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, April 9th, 2020. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio, which is north of New York City. And working from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk, our producer. And Taylor, I am coming off a day of massive regret.
What's up, Buster? What's hurting you?
All right. So we had that question, the Bleacher tweet yesterday from Brian Simpson, related to Al Kaline, Tony Gwynn, about how Al Kaline was known as Mr. Tiger, Tony Gwynn was known as Mr. Padre, and he asked the question about, you know, which other franchises has the Mr., and you know, I gave you some ideas of other players who might fit, and I totally whiffed on the most obvious answer, Mr. Cub, and man, I heard a lot of that on Twitter yesterday. Like,
roasted.
What were you thinking about? How could you not? Like, Ernie Banks is the most famous Mr. of some team, right?
Yeah. Twitter doesn't forget. They let you have it. So honest mistake, really. People were good natured about it, but I saw the responses and there were quite a few.
Hey, you know what? They were right. I was wrong. There's no getting around it. I absolutely, every bit of criticism on that is fair. But yesterday when I saw the first tweet mentioned, I was like, no, what an idiot. All right. Well, we'll try to get over that today. Manager Week continues. We heard stories from Joe Maddon and Bruce Bochy this week. And today we'll hear from Buck Showalter, who's got memories of Deion Sanders, of Randy Johnson, of that famous game, playoff game in 1995 when Edgar Martinez drove in Ken Griffey Jr. And he has strong opinions about proposed baseball rules. One note before we talk to June Lee, we had a great story about players connecting with fans using video games. A bat used by New York Yankees legend Lou Gehrig that dated back to 1922 was sold for $1,025,000 by Heritage Auctions in Dallas this past week. Taylor, what do you think? I just can't even imagine writing a check for something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the money itself is beyond my comprehension of my tiny brain, but yeah, I mean, it's a baseball bat. What are you doing? It's $1 million, really? I mean, you could make a replica and put it in your house and no one would ever question you. Literally no one would know the difference.
Well, and you know what? For a little bit more, I mean, once the Baseball Hall of Fame reopens, for just a little bit of money, you can go in and see a whole lot of bats, you know? All right. Before we get to Buck and June, I have to give the highest recommendation to the latest episode, SVP Pod. The gang's back together, SVP, Stanford Steve, and Ryan Russillo, all under one digital roof. If you know, you know. Find it wherever you get your podcast. June Lee covers baseball for ESPN. June, how you doing? How you holding up?
Good, good. Just trying to stay inside, stay sane generally, and just, you know, keep on going.
And try to connect with people and, you know, in baseball.
Yeah, yeah.
And have conversations, and there's so much uncertainty when you have those conversations generally.
Yeah, it's really, really weird right now. I mean, I was talking to a couple pitchers yesterday, or over the course of the last couple of days, just about the proposed plan that was going out about, you know, trying to maybe restart the season in April. And a lot of the players that I were talking to just didn't think it was feasible from like the practical standpoint, you know, the family stuff, not seeing your family for four and a half months, but also just, is there enough time to get guys ready for a proposed mid-May schedule? And then just generally, like, the logistics of everything, it seemed like there was a lot of mental hurdles for a lot of the players to get over in order to get to a place where this seemed feasible.
Well, and you mentioned you talked to a couple of pitchers. It's been interesting, but in the last 48 hours, I started to have conversations with people in the game who say that if we get into June, we get into early July when baseball can finally get the go and try to ramp up. What I've heard from folks in front offices is they think that it's getting closer to the point where we're going to need a full spring training, that you can't just 2 weeks and throw guys out there. What have you heard?
Yeah, I mean, I heard a similar thing. I mean, I was just talking to one of the pitchers about kind of building up his arm right now and what he's trying to do to just maintain his arm strength. And he told me a funny story about how he was going out and throwing balls against the fence and then it just started pouring. And so the balls added like another 10 pounds because of the water. And he said he felt like Charlie Brown. And that kind of, I thought summed up the state of the baseball season right now. Everyone wants to be playing baseball, but I mean, it's just literally not possible given pandemic circumstances. We've never seen anything like this before. It's really weird. You know, I'm 24 years old and talking to like my parents and my grandparents. Like my grandma's in her 80s and she's never seen anything like this before. So just to like have that kind of perspective on everything that's happening is, it's kind of, you know, reality shaking.
So I wanted to have you on to talk to you also about this great story you did for ESPN.com about how players are maintaining contact through video games. And I have some insight. You know, my son is 15. He plays a lot of video games. And so when initially his school was shut down and he's sitting at home, my thought was to feel sorry for him because, you know, back in the day when I was growing up in that situation, you wouldn't have had any contact with any friends. But he's talking with his friends all the time. And it's pretty clear that's what's going on with players.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing the same thing, too. I'm just talking to a lot of my friends from high school, you know, friends from around the country, and we all play video games. So it's just kind of an easy way to bond together. And so I've noticed that that was a thing that was happening in baseball clubhouses, especially with this new generation of players. You know, there was a lot of discussion. I talked to Andrew McCutchen specifically, who talked about how when he started his career, it was a lot of guys going out to steak dinners. It was a lot of guys getting drinks together at the hotel bar. And nowadays, in order to bond together, lots of guys kind of gather up in a hotel room together and they all play video games together. So, you know, McCutchen was talking about how a bunch of guys had Nintendo Switches. And then Carlos Rodon was talking about how when Chris Sale was with the White Sox, everyone would gather into his hotel room and they'd play video games together. Call of Duty, you know, Fortnite became kind of this mainstream explosion for the esports community over the course of the last couple of years. And it's a game that is super accessible to everyone. I think the thing that a lot of people in baseball clubhouses found is that, you know, baseball is such a diverse sport. It's often hard to find common grounds where players can kind of get to know each other and, you know, develop clubhouse chemistry, you know, the whole intangible thing. And video games is kind of this great equalizer because it's something that everyone kind of plays. It kind of helps guys forget that they're baseball players for a second and they can just kind of enjoy themselves and being competitive without, you know, placing, you know, financial bets on it. You know, that was something interesting that McCutchen told me was that, you know, despite the fact that you know, guys love gambling with cards and everything, video games kind of remain the sacred place where guys just were truly competitive, which I thought was so interesting.
Yeah, we heard similar things last week when we were talking to Jameson Taillon about how he's spending his days and what he's doing, you know, to basically while away the hours. What were some of the funny stories that you heard in working on the story?
It was funny because I was watching just Blake Snell's Twitch stream because he's been someone who's been extremely active in the video game community for a couple of years now. When he won his Cy Young Award 2 years ago, one of the first things he did when he got home was to go live on Twitch and give away a signed jersey to the people who were in his community. So it was really interesting to talk to Blake just about how, you know, he felt he really needed to emotionally invest himself into the Twitch community and his viewers. And it was a two-way relationship. It wasn't just a situation where, you know, fans who were coming in just wanted to ask him questions and then Blake would kind of walk away. Like Blake has a relationship with a lot of his viewers, which I noticed over the course, you know, of the last couple of weeks reporting out the story, and watching his streams more often. It was a lot of him investing his time and his energy and getting to know his viewers. And, you know, in the reporting of my story, there's a couple stories about how, you know, guys who were streaming on Twitch eventually became friends with other people who streamed MLB The Show, the video game for PlayStation, on Twitch as well. And they, you know, collaborate, and it would create this incredibly intimate relationship between a fan and a player that I don't think would have been possible before social media. And so it's really just interesting to see how the lack of sports and the lack of anything on the sports schedule has forced everyone to kind of pay attention to esports as kind of the only live sporting event right now, or competitive event right now. And it's bringing the fans and players close together because they're just bonding over video games in the same way that I think a lot of guys in the clubhouses were bonding over video games too.
So tell me what you think of this idea, because like a light bulb went off over my head as you were talking right there. And people, as you know, in these conversations the player associations is having with Major League Baseball, the feeling is, hey, no idea is a bad idea. They're going to have to figure out a way to rebrand the product, for lack of a better way to describe it, when they come back to draw fans in. And you know what? We talked about how there's always players in every game who you could mic up because they're not doing anything. How about during the course of, let's just pull the Rays. Let's say the Rays are playing in a game and Blake Snell is not pitching. Why not have, during the course of that game, have Blake Snell connect with the community and talk about the game? Have a conversation about the game going on while he's playing video games with fans. What do you think?
Kind of like bring, I like that because it's kind of bringing the chat room to real life.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's you know, the thing that I think is fascinating about Twitch specifically as a platform for players to express themselves is that you just have a camera pointed at you, and it's uncut for hours, unfiltered. And so the thing that I realized, you know, it's the thing I'm constantly thinking about as a reporter is how to translate the personality of these guys from in person in the locker room to print and trying to, you know, get fans to truly get a side of who these authentically who these guys are, you know, when they're not playing baseball. And I think Twitch is an incredible platform for that because you just see them kind of BSing and, you know, making jokes and being goofy. You know, Derek Holland talked to me about how when he plays Grand Theft Auto, he just does his Kermit the Frog impression and he does an impression of Cleveland from the Cleveland show. And that's something that he's been doing in the clubhouse as just like a class clown for, you know, as someone who brings levity and jokes to the clubhouse for his entire career. And now he's bringing that onto social media. And so I think guys are starting to realize that, you know, social media isn't something to be afraid of, something that might get you in trouble. It's a way to just kind of express yourself and put yourself out there in a way and see who connects with you.
And you know that there are old school fans who would hear something like that and be like, no chance. I hate that. I don't want to participate in that. That's fine. But there are clearly a lot of people, like my 15-year-old son, who would absolutely love something like that.
Yeah, I mean, as a 24-year-old baseball fan, as a someone who's kind of straddling between millennial and Gen Z, you know, I'm constantly thinking about, you know, what could we make baseball different in order to kind of push it forward and appeal to younger fans? And I think the thing that we've seen over the last couple of years between the mic segments that we've seen in spring training is that hearing that authentic side of players on the field or just generally, it really resonates with fans. You know, when we heard Mookie Betts, during that Red Sox spring training game talk about how, that he's not getting that ball, that clip went viral and it was one of baseball's biggest social media moments. And, you know, I think this is a really good opportunity to pause and kind of reflect on what's happening with baseball as a sport, and kind of think about, you know, what are some weird things that we might be able to try experimentally just to get people involved. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised just to see in the next couple of weeks if we see a more organized esports events coming together officially around MLB The Show, because it's something that clearly a lot of guys are starting to get involved in, and more guys are getting interested in opening Twitch accounts. Lucas Giolito of the Chicago White Sox, he just opened up a Twitch account after seeing Carlos Rodon enjoy it. So this kind of thing is starting to grow, and I think guys are starting to get a sense of how not only is it a way for players to connect with fans, but it's also a way for them to build their brands and, you know, build for a life outside of baseball as well.
Yeah, you could see it like in the regular workout regimen for some of these guys. Blake Snell lifts weights on Wednesday, has a bullpen session on Thursday. Has an off day on Friday. Saturday makes a start. Sunday he plays video games with fans during the course of game.
Right. I mean, baseball's almost uniquely positioned too. To, you know, there's so much downtime for a lot of these players. They can just kind of sit in the dugout and talk, and you can get a sense of what that dugout chatter is like. I mean, I think it's a really good idea, honestly. Now that I think about it twice, to mic up guys who aren't playing in the game, having a starter on his off day, just kind of chat with fans. It might be a really good way just to, you know, get a different side of players, and I think create a kind of a more uniquely intimate baseball experience.
Yeah, 100%. You did that in the clubhouse. That would be pretty cool. You bring people into that atmosphere. That would be amazing. All right, June, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster. I really appreciate it.
Buck Showalter has managed 20 years in the big leagues, 1,551 career wins. And Buck, as I bring you in, I'm excited about this conversation because I've known you for a long time. But as I said to Aaron Boone when we had him on a couple weeks ago, I never had asked him about that home run he hit in the 2003 ALCS. Because I worked with him, I didn't want to be like the green fly, you know, the fanboy asking questions. So this kind of gives me an opportunity to ask you questions like that.
Oh, don't ask me about anything that's really painful, please, Buster. No, bring it on. It's part of it. There's always a backstory of those things, you know?
But, yep.
There's so many things I wish I'd asked people along the way. Never feel like you're putting them out.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time and joining us for some storytelling when we're out without baseball games. A few years ago, I think your last year when you were managing the Orioles, I remember how you invited Deion Sanders to come to Camden Yards. And I didn't realize up until that time that you guys were very close. It made sense. You know, Deion was in the Yankees organization when you were in the Yankees organization. Tell me about him and how you guys always connected.
Well, Deion was, you know, he came from similar area of the country. There was a real connection. Deion's personality as a football player and the way he projected himself as a baseball player were two totally different guys. He wasn't prime time in baseball, and very smart guy. He still lives here in Dallas. His son is over at Southern Methodist. We sit together sometime at basketball games. But Deion was that group. We had a group in Albany, New York, in the Eastern League that won that year. And Deion was probably the most popular teammate there, not because he was prime time, just the way he treated everybody. He was just one of the guys. He understood the difference between, but I remember calling him to tell him he was going to the big leagues. And he thought I was telling him to go. He's going to AAA. And I called him at home one night. I said, his girlfriend, fiance, whatever, answered the phone. I said, hey, can I speak to Deion? She said, just a second. Deion would eat baked beans, pork chops, and scalloped potatoes almost every night. Loved them. And he finally gets to the phone. I said, D, what's up? He goes, I'm just eating. I said, well, listen, they want to call you up. They want you to go up. And he goes, fuck, you know, I love the guys here, man. We're going to win this year, I think. And AA, AAA is kind of a lateral move. I just soon stay here. And I said, D, you don't understand. You're going to New York. And he dropped the phone. I hear him going, baby, come here. Pick up this phone. Talk to Buck here. It was one of the great send-ups. Oh, I couldn't hardly get him back on the phone, but a lot of people didn't get Deion, and I enjoyed getting things about him. He was the fastest guy I ever had, not even close. Think about your fastest guy, and there's another gear there. He could actually outrun the baseball. It was breathtaking to watch him run a triple out. It was worth play being there. And just the things he could do on the field. I tell you, he threw well. He had a lot of power that people didn't know. If he had been full-time baseball, the sky was the limit. He was a special talent.
You know, Buck, I'm so thrilled to hear you say that, because when I have friends, you know, family, or if I do stuff with fans and people ask me what's the coolest thing that I ever saw on a baseball field, I said watching Deion Sanders hit a triple. That was, to me, the most amazing thing I'd ever seen.
Buster, people talk about stuff in the big leagues that I remember the most. It might have been coaching third base for an inside-the-park home run at Deion Sanders. Look it up sometime. Bo Jackson and him were going back and forth before we played Kansas City about he couldn't tackle, and Deion would say I could outrun him, and this guy was smart, and this guy wasn't smart. So by the time they got to New York, it was on. I mean, it was on. We weren't very good. We hadn't scored a run in a month. And the first two times up, Bo hits home runs. And Deion's a little down the dugout because, you know, it was Bo versus Deion. I kind of walked by him and said, come on, man, we got a lot of game left. Let's go. Well, he hits the ball in the right center field. And Bo dives for it, separates his shoulders, out for the year, by the way. Ball rolls to the fence. Deion comes around second, and it is beautiful. I mean, there's dirt flying. The Jerry curls are working. And he gets close to third, and I think it was Bianca Lana had his back to the infield just thinking it was a sure stand-up triple. And McFarland was kind of out in front of the plate, and I start pumping him. Like I said, we hadn't scored in a while. There's two outs, and Deion gets in another gear. He looks at me like this crazy guy's going to send me. And I got to tell you, Durwood Merrill's the home plate umpire, and the ball comes in. He's out by maybe 10 feet. I'm running down the line with him, obviously behind him. And the ball short hops and hits off McFarland's chest. Deion has to go up in the air over the top of McFarland, get his hand back on the plate, before he can retrieve the ball and tag him. It was bang, bang, safe. And I got to tell you, the place went crazy. Crazy. It was, I got to tell you, going back to third base, I'm going back in the dugout. Deion runs by me. He goes, brother, he said, have you lost your mind? What are you doing? I said, D, you got Bo showing you up out there. You got a chance, you know, to take it back. He goes, man, that was fun. That was fun, Buster.
Yeah, that's great. I was going to ask you if Deion asked you about the decision to send him in that situation. He would have absolutely been amazing. I want to ask you about working for George Steinbrenner. What was, of course, people know that behind the scenes he could be so tough. You know, all those years going through managers. What was the most angry that he ever got at you?
Oh, geez, Buster. Wow. You know, I think he would try to get at me through coaches. He knew that my soft spot was for coaches who were good coaches and doing their job. The reason why I left New York was over three or four coaches that he wanted to fire. But you know, it was like he would live through. I was lucky to have Gene Michael, who deflected a lot of those things, but he got a little easier to work for with every manager, I think. You know, I think Joe got a softer guy. I think the guy behind Joe got a softer guy. It was, you know, there were some very private moments where he would just hammer away, and he just liked, you know, anything that was obvious or he had told you about happening. I remember he came in early one morning, and Brian Butterfield and I were going doing the schedules. It must have been 7 o'clock in the morning. And he came in, all he said was, "You out." Didn't even call Butter by name. And so, of course, you know, Cleet Boyer gets a big name placard and puts it over Brian's locker, EWE. His new name was You. You out. But, you know, there was a certain fraternity and camaraderie of guys that, you know, you kind of took it. You knew it was coming your way, and you made sure you didn't drag somebody else into it. In other words, if you're the pitching coach, you don't say the infielders were out of position or they've made a bunch of errors behind your pitcher to try to support yourself. Because now you have dragged the infield coach into it, too. So there was, you know, you're going up the elevator late at night for one of those meetings. Everybody knows somebody's got a bullseye on their back. And you just need to wear it, take it like a man, because you know it'll be somebody else the next time. And guys would get back on the elevator and pat the guy on the back that wore it that time. And it was part of the job description. I understood it when I took the job that it was going to be part of the job description. But, you know, you could only take so much. If he knew that he could run all over you, you weren't going to be there. At some point, you had to take a stand.
All right. Tell us about Don Mattingly in the 1995 playoffs. I was not covering the team at that time, but Michael Kay, of course, longtime broadcaster for the Yankees, tells stories about Donnie ramping up for that series, knowing that that would be it.
Well, you know, it started about 3 weeks earlier. You know, we had probably one of the best Septembers in Yankee history to get in those playoffs. We had the replacement camp and all this stuff. It was awful. But Donnie, I had taken a lot of grief about continuing to play Donnie and hitting third because he's hitting about 260 with not much power numbers. But I knew his back was killing him. And I also knew that our players just funneled and fed off of him so much. He meant so much to our club just being on the field. And Donnie came in one day and said, "That's it, Buck. That's it. I'm going for it. Either you not hit me third." I said, "Listen, don't tell me where I'm going to hit you in the batting order." I'm going for it. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm going to start torquing my back and this and that, whatever. And if it blows out, it doesn't blow out." He said, "We're not getting the playoffs unless I start acting like a first baseman of the Yankees." So he went for it. I saw him there at 11 o'clock in the morning with all the stuff he did with his back just to try to get. And I got to tell you, Buster, for 2 or 3 weeks, it was Don Mattingly of old. I was like, "Oh, my God." Every swing you thought might be his last. And he put on a show in the playoffs. But I also remember coming back from Seattle. He came up, sat down. You know, you're talking about 3 games on that turf out there, too. He said, "Buck, I'm done. I just want you to know. I want you and Stick to know before the offseason gets here that I'm done. My boys need me at home. He had some situation at home. My back won't let me do what I need to do. I'm not sure about it." And so him telling us that, Buster, allowed us to go get Tino Martinez before the whole world knew that we needed a first baseman that could hold us up. It was actually the last deal that Stick and I made there. Was going after Tino and Jeff Nelson. And but Don had the guts and the foresight to tell us. But I got to tell you, the home run he hit in the playoffs, Buster, you could not talk to the guy next to you during that game. I actually thought the dugout was going to cave in. I'm not kidding you. I made a point of being out in front of the dugout a lot because it was shaking. That old building was shaking. And you had to go up the runway to talk to somebody. That's how loud it was. And when the ball left the bat that he hit the home run there, it was like, "Oh my gosh, everybody get to a nice safe place because this might get ugly." They had to pull the Mariners off the field after that home run.
Now, you asked me not to ask you about anything painful, but I did want to get your memory of one of the most famous moments in postseason history when Junior Griffey scores from first base and Edgar Martinez's double. What are your memories about that very moment and how did you handle that?
First of all, you know, Buster, they had 3 Hall of Famers, maybe 4 on that team. They were pretty good, okay? And if you look back, you know, I remember leaving Yankee Stadium and going, "How are we going to beat them one game out there?" It was like Randy Johnson seemed like every game. Steve Smith, the third base coach, the third base coach, I believe, later told me that he held Griffey up. He ran through the red light. And, you know, if you remember, John Wetland couldn't get anybody out. And we had used Mariano. I remember the grief we took for taking this youngster on the roster. But there's such a process of getting to the end. I mean, I think he set up for Wetland a year or so later. But, you know, it's funny. John Wetland came up to me years later with the Rangers. And he said, Buck, I need to talk to you. I had something on my heart for a long time. And I said, what do you got, John? He said, you know, I want to apologize for not being able to pitch in that game. Because it drove him the next year to have a great year. And he and Mariano were a great tandem. And he said, but I always felt like I should apologize to you for not being available to pitch in that situation. I went, John, really? John had carried that around with him forever. And it was such a relief for him to get it off his chest.
Tell me about your first look at Derek Jeter.
Jeez. My first look was he's in the dugout. Scouting director Bill Livesey said, hey, I want you to meet our first draft pick this year. Maybe 165 pounds soaking wet, about 6'1", 6'2". And I, you know, and then I met his mom and dad and his sister and talked to them for a while. And I said, yes, sir, this is going to be pretty good here because all the things that are going to challenge a lot of players off the field are not going to. He was brought up right. The way he interacted with his sister and his mom and dad, how alert his eyes were. You know, he this was a peripheral guy. He noticed the world going on around him, and he, you know, he reacted accordingly. But all the stuff that was going on, all he wanted to do was watch BP. He didn't want to get up, caught up in the hoopla and what was he wearing and what TV show am I on. I want to watch the Yankees hit and take infield. I thought that was pretty cool.
He tells a story about how he got sent. He got his first taste of the big leagues in 1995. You were the manager. Yeah. And he tells a story about how he and Rivera got sent to the minor leagues on the same day. And they were kind of crying together. Do you have any memory of that? Sending two future Hall of Famers in the same day in 1995?
Well, we brought them back. Okay. I will tell you this. I brought them all in. I brought them all in when I decided to take them on the postseason. You know, Derek, we had him travel with us just because I wanted him to be exposed to that. And years later, he said, you know, I thought that's where the Yankees were supposed to be every year. But he talks about a conversation. I had all those young kids in my office, and I said, listen, if I find out that you guys are running the streets and messing around up here, not using this time wisely, they got instructional league going on down in Tampa right now, and we can take your ass down there. Derek told me later, he says, man, we never left the hotel room for about a month. We were scared to death that you were going to hear something about us and send us out. But, you know, Derek was, you know, if it was all like him, I think the thing I can say about him is you knew that he was going to be as good as he was capable of being. Some guys you see the attitude or the upbringing, whatever, you're going, gosh, is this guy ever going to reach his potential? And you get worried about it. But Derek, you know, there was a real peace of knowing that he would be as good as he's capable of being.
Gene Michael told me a story once about flirting with the idea of trading Mariano Rivera in May of 1995. And I wanted to get your perspective on this because as Stick tells the story, you guys were talking to the Detroit Tigers about David Wells. And it's kind of being picked around. And then there's a minor league game, as Stick always used to tell the story. He got a report that Rivera's fastball, which, as Stick told the story, typically was 90, 92 miles per hour, and suddenly he's thrown 96, 97, and Stick called down to the minor league, It sounds like you've heard that story. Go ahead.
No, I haven't, but I believe there's a lot of Mariano stories that Gene was one of the best evaluators of talent, and quite frankly, Buster, I think that's why there's more poor evaluation of players in today's game, I think, than at any time I can remember, because those phone calls, you said phone calls, Gene would call everybody. He would get input. And then at some point, he would make the decision. But there wasn't anything he didn't know about a player, a Melito Perez or a Bob Wickman or all these people he would pick up, a Paul O'Neill. How many times he made phone calls and found out the little things that make you make good decisions on players? I got to tell you, he brought him up the first game he pitched for us. We spot started him in Chicago against the White Sox. And I'll forget. You know, he had no breaking ball, and he was supposed to throw like two or three, maybe four innings tops. And they were just starting to stretch him out. We got caught in the bind and needed a starter. I tell you, the first two innings get by, I look over at the pitching coach, Tony Cloninger. I go, my gosh, who is this guy? And then here we go again. He pitches another inning. Well, let's try one more. And it was like, and he's pitching without a breaking ball and without a cutter now. It was just late life fastball. It was a high fastball. And then when the cutter came around, it was over. But he, his breaking ball was awful, Buster. It was awful. It was back, it was a cement mixture back up, and it was just a twirly bird, and it wasn't good. But we kept looking around, go, who is this guy? This is pretty good right here. Let's try one more inning. We finally took him out and said, I got to check that box score today. I want to look at it, but I think he threw 4 or 5 innings.
And I think that one of the guys in the other lineup was John Kruk, because he used to like to tell that story about how they got the same scouting report you referenced. That, yeah, you know, yeah, this guy's coming up. He's kind of a number four type starter, not very good stuff. And Kruk, he said, like, the first at bat, he was like, what? Who wrote that scouting report?
Hey, the old scouts call it that come again action. The fastball, you think you're on it, and it takes another little hop at the end.
All right. So tell me about Curt Schilling and Randy Johnson and managing those two guys.
Oh, my gosh. You know, we traded for Randy. I'm sorry. We traded for Curt because he was hurt. You know, I remember Joe Garagiola talking about it, and I said, Joe, you know, if the reason he's available is because he's hurt. I mean, and we basically had to, you know, to set up him being the pitcher he was. But they were great for each other. You know, Curt would pitch a shutout or 8 shutout innings, and he'd walk by Randy, who's going to pitch the next day. He'd go, hey, top that one, you big so-and-so, and walk up the runway. Randy had steam coming out of his ears. And they'd go out there, and there was a very good competition in a very healthy way, and they fed off each other. Watching those two guys pitch, and one of the things I told Joe and our owner, Jerry Clange, I said, listen, if we can win the games that these guys start in the playoffs, we're world champions. They said, what do you mean? I said, well, they only got to win their starts. With the off days and the way the rotation goes in the playoffs, you only have to win their 2 games, and you're in. You win it all. And that kind of sold everybody on it. And when we got him, he wasn't healthy. He wasn't Curt Schilling. We had to, you know, you had to kind of rehab him. Back then, it was kind of touch and go. But those guys fed off each other. They did. Randy used to, I'd say, Randy, I want you to throw over to first base. He goes, no. Randy, you know, we'd put on the bunt sign, Randy would hit. We'd put on the hit sign, he'd bunt. We'd put on the hit and run, he'd take. I mean, it was, finally I said, Randy, here's the deal. You get up a set of signs and you give them to us and you tell us what you're going to do so at least the runner knows. Oh, no, we're not doing that. I said, well, Randy, you're not doing anything we put on anyway. It's like Pinella said, you'll like him every 5th day. And he was right.
Tell me about, from your perspective, when you were with the Texas Rangers, you guys wind up in that situation, maybe the most watched trade talks in the history of baseball, Alex Rodriguez on the market, and the talks between the Rangers and the Red Sox went on for weeks and weeks, it seemed like. Tell me about those.
Well, we had that deal when we got Soriano for Alex. We actually had a deal. We could have gotten a little bit deeper into it. We could have got Cano. We had 5 players to pick from.
Yep.
And the Yankees, as a player named later, one of them was Robinson Cano. And we ended up taking a guy that actually played in the big leagues, a utility infielder for a long time. But, you know, you could tell that Cano, they didn't have a number on his back. They were moving him from field to field where our scouts couldn't follow him as well. But we almost took Cano the way I understand it. But we could have had Robinson Cano and Soriano in that deal. But, you know, we couldn't move forward in Texas with that, like 30-40% of our payroll tied up in one player. And Alex was a really good player for us in Texas. You know, a lot of people forget he held up his end of the bargain there. But the Red Sox, we could have had Lowell in that deal. We could have done a lot of things back and forth. But it reminded me that timing is so important. And when you've got something, you got to go because it will go away. And they end up, I think, going to the Marlins, being a part of a world championship team down there.
Yeah, did you think at one point that he was going to wind up going to the Red Sox? Because it felt like, yeah, from the outside, like you guys were down to the 1-yard line.
Yeah, we had a pretty good deal worked out with them, too. But we felt like the player named later thing and the Soriano deal also gave us some flexibility with our payroll, which we needed in Texas. But, you know, that really good World Series team in Texas was put together as a result of that deal that John Hart made to set up the payroll there where they could afford to go get other players.
And that deal fell apart with the Red Sox in December, and then it wasn't until Aaron Boone blew out his knee playing basketball for the Yankees. And I know Brian Cashman, the Yankees general manager, worked like crazy to keep that information tamped down. When the Yankees reached out to you guys, was that do you remember hearing about that for the first time?
Yeah, we moved pretty fast on. You know, it's funny, Buster, is years later, my son said that somebody asked him, but hey, he was maybe 9 or 10 years old. He said, geez, your dad and them, they traded Alex Rodriguez. He goes, yeah, I knew about it. Cause he would act like he was asleep in the car, but he was listening to everything we were saying. He said, I knew about that deal 2 weeks ago. It's funny. Later on, so what else did you know? He said, well, I learned all the minor league reports and all the jargon because I would hear you guys talking, hear the minor league reports come in every night as we're driving home from the stadium. But I don't know. That was one of those deals that worked out great for everybody. But Soriano played well for us. He had some big years in Texas, but at a lot better rate of money.
All right. There's a couple of proposed rules that I want to ask you about. First off, as a manager, how do you like the idea of the 3-batter rule for relievers?
I understand what they're trying to do, but it's going to change the game. It's going to take away some jobs for certain people, but you know, someone said it's the continued castration of the major league manager. But, you know, if they think it's going to speed the game up and they've got some reason to believe it, it just, I don't know. I think, ask me after it plays for a year. I think you're going to put together your bullpen differently. I think you're going to look at guys different for the draft, even from your minor leagues. And It'd be like saying we're going to do away with the DH so you no longer are able to carry an Edgar Martinez. You know, you can think about some great left-on-left guys. And, you know, I think the more you take away strategy, the more that fans find it a little more sterile. You know, I think they like the time in between pitches and being able to second-guess guys. Buster, we did a game with nobody in the ballpark, okay? And it was 2 hours and less than 2 hours and 5 or 10 minutes. And the thing that hit me was how much faster we played the game. There was no walk-up music. There was no all this look at me, you know, gyrations. It was they played the game. And there's a way to speed the game up. The biggest thing you got to get into is the tempo of the way they play the game. I challenge you to look back in the late 70s, early 80s. Watch how much faster and the lack of fake drama there was in the game. It was let's play the game. It's a pure play on the game, and that's how they speed the game up. I'm not a big fan of because I think it really decreases the strategy and what fans can say what they would have done or wouldn't done. Hey, because now they're just going to say, hey, he couldn't do anything. It was a rule. I don't mind them saying that that managers have to make a quicker decision on replay. And they also, if a player tells you to check the replay and the player is wrong, there should be some penalty for it. You know, they stand out there at second, they go check that. What if they're wrong?
Which we certainly have seen examples of that. That's for sure. What do you think about the idea of an electronic strike zone?
You know, on the surface, I don't like it, but I got to tell you, I've seen the technology. I was on the competition committee, but this isn't something they're just pulling out of the air, and they're not, and there'll be some bumps along the way. Could you imagine watching a pro or college football game, Buster, without instant replay, and you know you're going to get it right? You know, it's very frustrating sometimes when they say a human error is part of the game. Oh, really? Is it? You know, everything we've done in society, we try to eliminate human error. But I'm not as down on it as everybody thinks I would be. I think until you've been in a dugout and had, you know, there's so many borderline pitches that they can call ball or strike and not be penalized for. But now there's a certain – the only time you ever can get thrown out of a baseball game or get mad is balls and strikes. I mean, on the bases, and they've eliminated a lot of the vindictiveness that some of the umpires from years past might have on, you know, kind of rookie hazing and how tough they'd make it on some of the guys. But I got to tell you, Buster, I think if you see how good the technology is and how long they've been working on it, you might embrace it a little bit more.
Buck, I think the thing that I would be, I mean, for lack of a better way to say it, the most sad about if they go to electronic strike zone and how it would change the position of catcher, which I've always loved to write about. And it's been so much the central part of baseball. that makes me wistful about the whole thing, that all of a sudden this position where, you know, managing a game and handling the pitchers, all like 90% of that would go out the window.
Yeah, are you talking about catchers that framing?
I'm talking about that, and I feel like it'll become an offensive position, much in the way first base and second base would become, especially because, you know, I've heard from some major league catchers, they believe within 5 years, you potentially are going to see front offices calling balls and strikes, dictating balls and strikes, not balls and strikes, but pitch selections for catchers, that a lot of that stuff will come from the analysts.
Yeah, that's where we got back about the three hitter rule. I mean, if we get too sterile and there's no human element as far as the game itself. I mean, what have we taken out of the game if in football by having instant replay? I just don't know. There's not much interaction with umpires today anyway, and the you know, it's like they're talking about this. You can't throw over to first base and A ball and rookie ball there without stepping off. Now that's silly, because what's going to happen? You're going to make the game longer. You know, just to educate anybody listening, basically an A ball and rookie ball, they're going to have a rule that you cannot throw over to first base from the stretch without stepping off first. So that eliminates the left-hander having a good move. That means that you're going to step off, hold the ball, try to change up the timing of the runner. And catchers, and that's what brought it to mind, Buster, catchers, you don't care if they can throw anymore because they can't throw anybody out. So it's going to be a hit and catch. And if they take away that, they don't even have to worry about frame anymore. And I think framing is one of the most misunderstood things out there, because umpires don't wait to see how you catch it before they call ball and strike. They're making a decision before the ball's in the glove.
Yeah, 100%. And you and I have talked about that and how, you know, those statistics sometimes can be deceiving. Buck, I appreciate your time on this. I love hearing stories. And I always wanted to ask you about Steinbrenner. I always wanted to ask you about Don Mattingly in the 95 playoffs.
Well, you're going to make me have to think about what was probably the biggest down moment with Mr. Steinbrenner. Maybe next time.
Okay. I appreciate it, Buck.
All right, Buster. Thanks for having me. Y'all take care of yourself and stay safe, man.
Here's Tim Kirchens, Baseball Fix, about Bo Jackson.
On this date in 1993, Bo Jackson, in his first game with an artificial hip, hit a home run. Bo Jackson is one of the most remarkable athletes ever to play Major League Baseball. I think at one point he was the fastest and the strongest player in the game at the same time. Jimmy Stewart, a scout, jokingly said once that he saw Bo hit a 500-foot homer, run and catch it before it hit the ground, and then threw it back to home plate in the air. George Brett told me he never missed an at-bat by Bo Jackson. He said, "I've never gone to the bathroom while Bo was at the plate because I might miss something that I've never seen before." And I was there that night at Memorial Stadium when Bo made a running catch and then ran up the left center field fence like a race car on a ramped track. I've never seen anything like that, and I never will again.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. First up, P.K. Steinberg, our guy. He writes in, which manager, historical or current, would you most want to sit on the bench with for a game?
Now, I kind of, P.K., had that opportunity the last decade working on Sunday Night Baseball. Because I'm not far from where the managers are, and I've actually had conversations, you know, sporadic conversations with some of them during the course of games. Like, they'll look over at me and, you know, give me a thought or give me an idea. But to actually sit down with them the entire game, I think from history, Leo Durocher, who was famous for yelling at players on the other teams, I'd love to know if that was actually the case. And then I think among current managers, I'd love to sit next to Alex Cora, who is apparently really good at connecting with players during the game. Ron Renicki, the interim manager for the Red Sox, talks about that. I'd love to be able to hear that as it's happening. That would be neat.
I love the idea of a manager heckling opposing players. That's fantastic.
Man, it used to happen all the time.
Needs to happen more across all sports. We got Mitchell at Tigers_of_DET writing in, if you had to build a rotation based on postseason accolades over the past two decades, who follows Mad Bum?
Yeah, boy, postseason accolades. It's funny, when I first read this question, I didn't see the specific tie to postseason accolades. You know what? I covered Jake Arrieta's tremendous playoff game. What was it, in 2015, the wild card game? That was phenomenal. John Lester, I think, absolutely would have to be in that mix. Justin Verlander has had a lot of great moments in the postseason. Max Scherzer, boy, game seven of 2019. That was really cool. Mm-hmm. And just generally speaking, I think any rotation that you have to piece together, Jacob DeGrom would have to be in there.
Jason Amico at Jason Amico writes in, when covering something controversial like the Astros sign-stealing scandal, how do you try to cover the story fairly and accurately while not tarnishing or jeopardizing your rapport with the players? Inside baseball question here.
Yeah, you just got to be honest. And if it jeopardizes your rapport, that's the way it goes. But you have to be honest and you have to be direct in your reporting. I'll give you an example. You know, Carlos Correa is someone that I've gotten to know well. I did a couple of E60s on him, went down to Puerto Rico. You know, I really like him. I think he's a good guy. If you remember that press conference, the day of the press conference with the Astros, when he spoke to reporters in the clubhouse that day, I thought he did a phenomenal job. And I talked about that on air. And the next day, when he went much further and was talking specifically about specific moments that the Astros did not benefit from sign stealing in the 2017 postseason, I thought he went too far. And I told him that. And if I had seen him in person, I would have told him that then. And if, you know, he wasn't, and I know Carlos well enough to know that he can separate those two, but I've had players get mad and that's just the way it goes. You know, you're not there to be friends with them.
A dog ignoring you after you go on vacation. That's how I feel like it goes when that sort of thing.
There
happens.
You go.
Last one, Senior Hendricks at Senior Hendricks writes in, what percentage of revenue do home games bring in for Major League Baseball teams with all the ticket and food and drink sales? I know it's sizable, but I also know TV contracts are enormous. How much is lost by simply not having fans?
Well, it's enormous. And it really depends on the particular team. You know, baseball is so much different than the NFL, where it feels like, generally speaking, you have all the revenues thrown under one pot and they basically split it. In Major League Baseball, it's so much different in terms of, you know, each team having a different television contract locally, each team depending more or less on the money generated on game day. I think generally speaking, small market teams are hurt worse by not having game day crowds. They are, I think they're more reliant on that than teams, say, like the Yankees.
Alrighty, that does it for Bleacher Tweets. You can use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter, Orioles fans, to direct your ire at Buster for not asking any Orioles questions to Buck Showalter. So that there's that.
You gave me some. Buck was going. He had great stories about Deion Sanders and, you know, Randy Johnson. I love the Don Mattingly stories.
Yeah, hey, everything was great.
I couldn't get the question.
It's all good. We'll have him back on again. And do subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast, wherever you listen to your podcasts. And do you want to tease who we have tomorrow? We don't quite have him locked in, but what do you think here?
I'm pretty sure that we're going to get Dave Martinez of the Nationals. That's what we've been told. We just haven't locked in the time. And next week, we're going to refer to his Hall of Fame week. And we got a couple of Hall of Famers lined up. Mike Piscina, who is, of course, just recently inducted, and Jim Palmer, among the Hall of Famers, are going to have next week, and a couple of other exciting possibilities that I need to confirm. That's it for today. My thanks to Buck Showalter, to June Lean, and Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/PodCenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.